since World War II. During a supposed golden age of peace, the United States military has killed or helped kill some 20 million people, overthrown at least 36 governments, interfered in at least 82 foreign elections, so way ahead of Russia in that regard, attempted to assassinate over 50 foreign leaders and drop bombs on people in over 30 countries, responsible for the deaths of 5 million people in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, and of course we already saw about 2.5 million since 2003 in Iraq. If you go to his website at davidswanson.org, you can find this information. I'll have it up on a slide later. These are all the countries that the U.S. has invaded, put together. This is over, you know, over time since the beginning of the 20th century. But this includes deployment of the military to evacuate civilians, covert military actions by U.S. intelligence, etc. But you can see, yeah, it's a pretty broad swath of the world. And this is, you know, this kind of looks like a little bit like an empire to me, doesn't it? Where we have over 800 military bases, or there's sometimes debate over what is or is what not a base and all that sort of thing. But this is gives you a pretty good idea of what that situation looks like. So now that we've talked about the immorality of our government's conduct, let's turn now to the fact that they're illegal under international law. In the years after World War I, a very powerful peace movement arose in the United States and around the world. It was called the Outlawry Movement. David Swanson writes about this extensively as well in some of his books. And what it was aimed at was making war illegal. And it succeeded. It succeeded. A number of countries signed this thing called the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which, very simple, really Article 1 and Article 2, two sentences say it all, that the contracting parties, the signatories, declare that they condemn resource to war for the solution of international controversies and renounce it as an instrument of national policy, and that they agree to settle all their disputes or conflicts by pacific means, meaning, you know, without resort to any type of military action. When the treaty became effective on July 24th, 1929, there were a number of signatory parties to it, and then there were others that signed it since then. Now, I know the list here does not include Iraq, Libya, or Syria, or Yemen, but it's important to point out, go back to Article 1, if you signed it, that means you renounce war as an instrument of foreign policy, so it's not just limited to the other signatories to the treaty. I'm sorry?
We're not on there, is it?
Oh, no, they did. It is. We did sign it.
We did.
Yeah, yeah. These are the other signatories. The United States signed it.
Signed?
On that date, July 24th, 1929 was when it was signed. It's actually in the United States Code, and you can find it, the statute at large, at that citation there. So it's part of the law of the land. Also, the United Nations Charter forbids aggressive or preemptive war. Article 2 and Article 51 both forbid member nation states from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any other state. So, you know, clearly just applying the United Nations Charter, all of these actions of the United States since 2001 have been plainly illegal under established international law. It's also important, I think, to note a little bit of history that, you know, what our nation is doing now is exactly what we condemned after World War II at the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg, when the United States, Soviet Union, France, and Great Britain got together and set the rules for prosecuting Nazi officials for crimes against peace and war crimes. By the way, I would highly recommend Robert H. Jackson, passed away, of course, some years ago, but there is a website in his memory, and you can find the prosecuting documents, and the opening statement he made at the Nuremberg prosecution is well worth reading, going into that. I would highly recommend it, and it's not too difficult to find. This was also codified as part of the United Nations in 1950. And this is the thing, you know, frequently when you hear about war crimes, you hear about, you know, horrendous acts committed in a war. But it's important to remember subsection A, those are in subsections B and C, talking about war crimes, subsection crimes against humanity. But there's this thing called crimes against peace. War itself is the first crime, right? It's illegal. Even planning, preparation, or conspiring for the accomplishment of going to war, these are international crimes against peace. So the fact that sometimes, you know, you see these stupid debates in the Washington Post and elsewhere about, well, you know, it's debatable whether these things are legal because of the, you know, authorization for the use of military force. That's beside the point, right? The AUMF did not authorize any of these under international law. The Nuremberg principles themselves make that very clear. The fact that you don't have an internal punishment for it doesn't mean make it suddenly legal under international law. One point, just kind of by way of mentioning something more contemporary here, that it's important to also realize that economic sanctions and support for subversion and insurrection in other nations, like the, what was it, 82 examples that David Swanson gives, those are also illegal under international law. And I give some citations there under the Charter of Economic Rights and Duties of States under the United Nations General Assembly, and some other sources of law there. They're also, of course, in violation of our Constitution. It really, for two reasons. One, any treaty to which the United States becomes a signatory then becomes the law of the land, so they're unconstitutional for that reason. That includes the UN Charter, that includes the Nuremberg Principles, that includes the Kellogg-Briand Pact, but also Article 1, Section 8 of our Constitution gives Congress the exclusive authority to declare war. Unfortunately, we have had a Congress that is heavily invested in the military-industrial complex and or is too cowardly to do anything about it and actually exercise that authority. So we've seen over decades now is just completely abdicating that authority to the executive branch and allowing presidents to make war more or less when they please or where, when their corporate overseers decide that they need to go to war. That's pretty much how things have been happening. It's also one of the reasons why we on the Green Party Peace Action Committee recently proposed pledges for our candidates, Green Party candidates, for Senate, state, for government, U.S. House of Representatives, and President to sign that will basically say we will adhere to international law and we will hold the President responsible if he violates international law and our Constitution. Just a quick side note here that in 2011, Dennis Kucinich actually called out President Obama very briefly. He kind of backed away from it, but actually suggested that President should be impeached over the airstrikes against Libya. And there's this telling quote from President Obama in 2000 saying basically what I just pointed out. President doesn't have the authority to do this. It's unconstitutional. Well, President Obama forgot what candidate Obama said. And went ahead and authorized this anyway. But yeah, should have been impeached. Probably every president since FDR, at least, should have been impeached for what they've done. All right, with that, let me turn now to these wars not being in the national interest. I'm trying to see how I'm doing on time here. Hold on. Okay, got to move things along. Well, all right, so my thesis here is that they're fought to benefit the wealthy owners of the banks and corporations, the profiteers from war. Well, let's consider four pieces of evidence. First of all, well, did we go and strike Libya to prevent a bloodbath? Well, no, that is not why our government went to Libya, because there was never any bloodbath to begin with. There was no threat of one. Highly recommend this article by Alan Cooperman that goes into this. And basically pulls that whole thesis apart that we did it to protect, you know, the so-called duty to protect that we hear about. That's not why the United States and France and the other nations went into NATO. I would suggest the real reasons were, one, there was oil, and two, there was gold. Libya had quite a bit of gold. And three, there was also Gaddafi was threatening the international monetary order by threatening to stop selling Libyan oil in U.S. dollars and instead demanding payment in gold-backed dinars, this pan-African currency that he was promoting. That's when he got real dangerous to the powers that be, and they decided he had to go. And some of the notorious Clinton emails that were released by WikiLeaks actually show that they were aware of this at the time, and the French government in particular was motivated to do this, that the basic purposes in mind were to obtain Libyan oil, ensure French influence in the region, increase then-President Sarkozy's reputation domestically, and assert French military power. Also, I recommend this article by Dan Glazebrook that talks about it, that he attributes three strategic goals that were served by this. First of all, remove Gaddafi himself. It also put an end to Gaddafi's efforts to build a pan-African system that was based in Libya, challenge to U.S. and European hegemony. And also, it will allow the country to be looted, basically. And also, I mentioned as a spinoff, one of the spinoffs was the war in Syria, but also funds found their way to different terrorist groups throughout the continent of Africa. Well, now suddenly we need more U.S. presence there to protect against the terrorist threat. Funny how these things work. And AFRICOM has become more important. Example number two, Syria. This very good article by Robert F. Kennedy that appeared in Politico, Kennedy Jr., 2.5 years ago, basically pointing out that the troubles there began when Bashar Assad decided he didn't want this natural gas pipeline to go from Qatar through its territory. And as he pointed out, instead he approved this Russian-approved Islamic pipeline running from Iran through Syria to the ports of Lebanon. And according to some of the documents released by WikiLeaks, it was after that that the CIA became involved in deciding that Bashar al-Assad had to go, and began funding opposition groups in Syria. I'm going to kind of try to go a little faster so through some of these slides at this point. We've got a little bit of a late start. But basically, this idea, this was part of the Arab Spring and it just got out of control. Now, there were arms that were being funneled to the rebels in Syria through what was called the rat line out of Libya. Frankly, we're being told that, well, the reason we're in Syria is we're fighting terrorists, right? Well, if we're fighting terrorists, why is the United States supporting terrorists? A lot of these funds end up with Al-Qaeda. Some of them end up with ISIS. A couple of articles here from Consortium News that kind of talk about that. The stuff that went to the Free Syrian Army didn't stay with them for very long, and they were not much of a factor in the fighting. Example three. We're told, well, the reason we intervene in these countries is we're promoting democracy, we're against dictatorships. Well, turns out we're not opposed to dictatorships. The United States is the leading supporter of dictatorships. I did a study about 2.5 years ago. I'm still working on an update to the study, but basically examining both State Department and Defense Department documents, I generated a chart showing all of the world's dictatorships and then how much the United States was providing in training and military sales and military sales deliveries, and I generated a chart. And the result, now this is using Freedom House, which itself is a Western biased source, but they create their own list of what they regard as dictatorships. And they categorize 49 nation states in the world as dictatorships. of those 49 dictatorships, 36 of them, over 73%, were receiving U.S. military training or authorized weapons sales. So we're supporting nearly three-fourths of the world dictatorships. Actually, since then, it's gone up. It's a little over three-fourths now. This was the article I had in Truth Out back almost 2 years ago. I really need to get that update done. But this is what the list of the different countries, different dictatorships around the world that are receiving some form of military aid from the United States. And obviously, I don't know why is that thing there? Well, I don't know why that thing is showing up there all of a sudden. But anyway, the other factor is, of course, the military contractors themselves make a lot of money. This was an article that I found that talked about how different military contractors were at a Credit Suisse investor conference, and they were basically talking about how great it was that the U.S. bombing campaign had been stepped up, and isn't it great that Russia came into Syria, because now there'll be even more war and we're going to sell more weapons. So basically they were congratulating themselves about that. So the other reason why they're not in the national interest is that wars do not make us more safe, and they're costing us dearly at home, both directly and indirectly. War is self-defeating. It hasn't made us more safe. This is something that is empirically true. There are actually more terrorist groups in the world with more people in them, not surprisingly, since the so-called war on terror began, which you would kind of expect if the United States is making so many enemies around the world. This is something that's been verified. It is a losing economic proposition for the American worker. There's President Eisenhower's famous declaration in 1953, talk about every gun made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, is a theft from those in hunger who hunger and not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. It necessarily means money, labor, time, the expertise of our scientists all being directed toward making more means of death. Costs, this is actually a little bit outdated, but you can see what the average taxpayer owes just for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. We're now at $5.9 trillion, and this may even not really count all of it, but it's at least that figure since 2001. So basically pretty close to $1 billion a day is what we're spending on these wars, counting the ongoing costs of them. The War Resister League also does their own calculus. They are another good resource for this. The National Priorities Project has this website where you can kind of look at the trade-offs of what just a 10% cut in the budget would mean in terms of, you know, number of teachers you can employ, number of clean energy jobs you could create, and so on.
This?
It's at the National Priorities Project. They have an ongoing calculator on the cost of war. And let's see. Well, we also spend, this is actually a little outdated too, from fiscal year 2016, but at that time, more on, I would put quotes around defense, than the next eight countries combined. And here we are in 2020. This is, I think, is important information for Greens to consider. Last year, the Pentagon budget, overwhelmingly supported, bipartisan fashion, most Democrats in the House and Senate voted for it, actually giving the Trump administration $1 billion more than what he requested. And then, right up to just what happened the last few weeks, there's the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. Democratic Party wanted to up it to $733 billion, Republicans the $750. So my wry commentary, well, gee, that means a moderate would be want a budget of $741.5 billion, split the difference. Kind of really highlights, you know, the two-party system right there, and the so-called difference between the two parties.
This is...
Who voted against it?
Tulsi and Bernie, I think.
Right. You mean at the last one?
Yeah.
I'm not sure of that right off the top of my head. There were a few others that voted against it, but you know, some of them that vote against it maybe because they wanted to spend more money. So you can't always go justify that.
Actually, I think Bernie and Warren didn't vote.
This is the other thing. This is really important, I think, because we keep hearing, well, you know, but the military creates jobs, and this is how the military-industrial congressional complex works. But it doesn't create jobs. It actually destroys jobs because of, you know, an analysis of what the actual economic effects are would really establish that. And Robert Pollan and Heidi Garrett-Peltier, of the economists with the University of Massachusetts, did this study a few years ago and pointed out that for every $1 billion of spending, nominally you create 11,200 jobs. But if you literally gave an across-the-board tax cut and didn't spend that money and just didn't tax it in the first place, you'd create almost 4,000 more jobs, right? So it's actually destroying jobs by spending that money. And then if you take more of a green approach and, you know, do some of the things we want to do with a Green New Deal and put in a clean energy, you create even more jobs. For every $1 billion, healthcare would be more, education would be a lot more. So that I think is a takeaway here, and something we need to really convey to the American people is no, they're not creating jobs. They are destroying jobs when they spend the money on this. There's also the climate change aspect of this, and there's some facts and figures that I got from World Beyond War. The military uses more fuel per day than the entire country of Sweden. The U.S. military uses enough fuel in 1 year to run the entire mass transit system in the United States for 22 years. Other facts and figures. We also have at our table down there some handouts, if they're still there, on the impacts of this. This is an important point as we try to connect our movement, the peace movement, to the movement for climate solutions.
Sorry, can we just have that reference again to that last slide?
Oh yeah, this is from a publication called, it's by World Beyond War, and they have a publication called The Global Security System, an Alternative to War. It's the 2018-2019 edition. You can find it there. It costs a little money to buy it, but it's if I actually have it with me, but it's a really good publication. But the free handouts we have downstairs have a lot of the same information. So, and
this is going to be available too, right, on the website?
Yes. Yes.
Whole presentation.
Yes. So, in concluding, I'd like to just remind us of what Martin Luther King said a year before his assassination, year to the day, I believe, that if we, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than in programs of social uplift, is approaching spiritual death. Well, if that was true in 1967, we're a goddamn corpse now. But we have to fight back. We have to try to reclaim, the actual spirit of this country. So I'd like to conclude by saying that as we go about our daily lives, we naturally try to enjoy life as best we can. We enjoy the company of loved ones. We go about trying to enjoy the good things of this world. But we have to remember that every day that we are here in the United States, we're kind of enjoying what you might call an imperial privilege. Right? Because we're inflicting horrible, untold misery on millions of people across the world. And the fact that we don't see it on a daily basis, it isn't put in our faces like this on a daily basis, is no excuse not to be involved. And I'm proud to say that the Green Party is taking lead, but hopefully you can use this to help you in your future efforts to make the people of the United States care again. Because I think that's the first step. Mm-hmm. Here are some of the organizations, I think, that are leading the struggle for peace. United National Anti-War Coalition, which we're involved in, I'm involved in. World Beyond War is a great website. That's where you get the book that you were asking about. Black Alliance for Peace, Jammu Baraka is heavily involved in that, highly recommend that. Coalition Against U.S. Foreign Military Bases, our own organization, and also you can find GPACs if you go to gpus.gpacs. You can find our website. And these are some of the other sources that I check pretty regularly. Antiwar.com is good, Consortium News is good, Black Agenda Report, etc. Yes?
I just wanted to add WAM, Women Against Military Madness.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for that. Also, Veterans for Peace. I didn't put them up there, but they're another great organization. So, I don't know. I may have taken up all my time. I don't know. Go ahead if you have a question.
Okay, let's get to some questions. I think probably most of us would know most of what you've covered, so I think it's good to have some dialogue as to where we go from here. A couple of quick comments. You raised the question of why is there a decline in protest? Oh, it suggests that a lot of it has to do with a sense of futility. It's not that people don't care. It's that whatever we do hasn't made any difference. You know, what else could we do?
Right.
So I think that needs rather than put a blame on people not caring. Another thing that we could use in combating those who say, well, we got to have a strong military to keep us safe, is to say, well, how successful is the military in preventing the tornadoes, the firestorms, the droughts, the floods, the wildfires in California?
Right.
What does safety mean to you?
Yeah.
You
know?
Well, what does the military do to prevent or stop any of that? Obviously, that will, there's no answer that they can't. It's ineffective. Mother Nature is so much more powerful than all these bombs and missiles.
Right. And how do you define safety, too? The other part of that answer is, you know, what is real security consist of? You know, when you don't have health care and you don't have education and you don't have decent jobs, that's the kind of security we should be talking about. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Yes?
Speaking to the issue of spreading the word, this year there are municipal elections all over the country. And it was London, Connecticut. We are running a candidate for mayor, Frieda Bergen, the daughter of Phil Bergen and Elizabeth Pallister, for mayor. We're also a town that's heavily invested in the military-industrial complex, a big employer is Electric Boat. And so we have the opportunity to bring the issue of economic diversity and, you know, climate change to our mayoral race. And I'd recommend that, you know, in other parts of the country, we think about local races as ways to get the word out to people who are our neighbors.
I agree with that, but bear in mind that, you know, you can't really directly affect the military industrial complex running for local office. But you know, I agree that's an important building block.
The people who are local are going to be voting for our congresspeople.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wait a minute. Not only that, but the local people can't afford it. That's your point. They can't afford
it. Right.
Our economy in London is not sustainable because it is dependent on two subsidies.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, Bill.
Thank you very much, Rich. This was really superb. I will only add one thing. I disagree with the word you said, but there's something you didn't talk about. The group that gave a very forceful panel right before the 2003 war, where I teach, the University of South Carolina, was the Israeli lobby. And the people in South Carolina who were instrumental in the Israeli lobby. And they had a special guest speaker, Tom Friedman from the New York Times.
Oh, Christ, yeah.
Okay, could you say a word or two about the role of the Israeli lobby in all of this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, AIPAC, you know, practically holds Congress hostage. I mean, that's, you know, and look what happens when one or two Congress people speak out against that. Look what happens to them in the national media. So, yeah, clearly, you know, I don't go as far as some people and say, well, it's the tail wagging the dog. It's more complicated than that. But clearly, the Israeli lobby plays a huge influence. And I think in part of the planning about what the goals are in the Middle East, witness the hostility against Iran today. A lot of that is coming from that lobby, certainly. But a lot of it is also just domestic. I mean, there's a convergence of interest there. Yes, Eugene?
But overthrowing the Iran nuclear deal, the nation or the factor most important in that, I think, is Israel. And that is very powerful. And that what that sets up is the momentum for war.
Yeah, indeed. We're kind of over, but maybe one or two more. So we'll go to you and then you. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm very impressed. Thank you for all this information. I just wanted to add one thing also about the money. I know the weapons manufacturers get very wealthy, you know, so there's a push for war, right?
Right.
But the real push, historically and today, is the fact that our government borrows to have war, and it borrows from the too big to fail banks.
Sure.
And by keeping us, our government, in debt, which they have just been total from the beginning of the Cold War, right? Because we haven't disarmed, we've just gotten more and more. By keeping our government in such debt, we're taxed more and more to pay for the interest on the $22 trillion, right? And we're more and more ourselves kept into debt, so we can't fight them.
Yeah, and I understand that, and that's why the other aspect, one other way of attacking this is the greening the dollar program that the Green Party is also propagating is one way of getting out of that. Certainly big finance capital plays a huge role in keeping this whole thing going. I would agree with that. Last word.
Well, okay, I just wanted to say, this is very good, and I think one of the reasons we don't see in protests about war because it's so whitewashed. We don't see the deaths. We don't see how it actually, because there's no honest reporting by the media, like, look at all this uranium depletion and all the waste, like you were saying, the energy and the jet fuel and so on, and then all the deaths. I mean, there's a film called Last Men in Aleppo. I would highly recommend people seeing that because you see what the white hats in Syria, and it's so moving.
But the white helmets?
Yeah, the white helmets, that's it. And anyway, it shows war. You get to see it, and you see children. You see them pulling babies out of buildings. And just it's hard to watch, and yet when you see it, I mean, you come out of it, and just really, everyone that we had at it, you couldn't really say anything. I mean, it just was just mind-boggling. So if you get every chance to show that at your church or your community group or somewhere, and then get people to see that film.
What was the name again?
Last Men in Aleppo.
Okay.
And so that's just one thing. And I mean, and finally, I think what we're seeing in all this is it's money in elections. If we don't get money out of elections, this is why this stuff keeps happening, because they donate to candidates. The candidates are strategically put military, like either bases or they have factories and like you were saying, with the jobs.
Right.
And so that's where all this comes from, and that's why that we have to change that paradigm. You think like there's, like you were showing, there's not the need for war as much as the need for these other things that would be even better. But we have to somehow, that's our challenge to get that out there, that paradigm change.
Final pitch before I let you go.
I just want, since this is awesome, could you tell us again how to get access to the slides?
It is at the annual national meeting website now, and it should be at the Green Party Peace Action website soon. You know, once we get an updated one up there. And you can also email me if you want me to send a copy. I'd be happy to share that with folks after, if you'd like, you know, my email address. Final word is, because we're way over, is just Green Party Peace Action. We would love more participation from more state parties. It's not that hard to sign up. You basically ask your state party for permission to be appointed to the committee. You can have up to 3 representatives per state. And we have a table downstairs for taking names. So see if you can, if you're interested, we'd love to have you.
Just a quick, are we all, out of time?
No, why not?
Oh, we're not?
We are, no, I think we have plenty of time.
Oh, I misstuck. I thought we were supposed to end at 2:30.
No, 2:45.
Okay, all right. Then let's keep going. All right, I apologize. All right. Yes, then we'll come back to you. Yes.
Yeah, a couple things. I wish that you would expand definition of war. I think it's too narrow. War on migrants. War on the poor. War on people of color. I mean, I think our definition is too narrow. The second is, I think it would be very interesting to chart the strength or weakness of the peace movement and, like demonstrations and stuff, and whether the Democrats are in power in the presidency or whether the Republicans. When you look at the nuclear freeze, that was the beginning of Reagan's presidency. And no one was physically dying at that time.
Right,
stuff.
Right.
I think that the Democrats are the graveyard of social movements, and especially the peace movement, right? You know, it's like what becomes intolerable in terms of when the Republicans are in party becomes excusable for the Democrats.
Oh, yeah, and I kind of alluded to that at the outset. As far as your first point, I kind of half agree with you. There are times you can use terms like, you know, the war on the poor, but there is still something to be said for clarity. There is difference between that kind of war and bombing people, right?
Yes. War on the migrants. War on the migrants.
Right.
I
understand the rhetorical attraction of that, but there is something to be said for keeping a focus on what our government is doing to these other countries. I think you were next, then we'll come to you. Yes.
I've got a question. I was talking about this to a person, and we were discussing. He got the point about this issue, military-industrial complex. But he made something very interesting. He says, why don't we shift? All right, bringing down the expenditure is one thing, but why not shift the focus from a war footing to a peace footing with the same budget, or a lesser budget, in
right.
terms of, instead of building an aircraft carrier, build hospital ships. Instead of building bases, triple the rail system in the United States and North America. Can we take the industrial military complex and shift it to peacetime and environmentally friendly activities?
Well, absolutely. As a matter of fact, it's an integral part of the Green New Deal, at least our Green New Deal, is doing exactly that kind of thing. They used to call it peace conversion. Remember when the maybe you're too young to remember, but when the Cold War ended in 1991 or so, there was this whole push. Well, see, now we don't have to spend as much on the military. Let's have this peace conversion. And there was talk about it, and the Clinton administration did use some of that money to retire some of the debt, but you didn't see any kind of wholesale peace conversion. So it goes back to the point that you made so eloquently about that's where good ideas go to die, is this thing called the Democratic Party. It never came to fruition, but the idea is certainly not new. And it lives on in the Green New Deal.
So it's not a red herring. It's not just something people.
Oh no! I mean,
valid possibility.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the same engineering talent, the same industrial capacity. Yeah, it would have to be retooled, but we can be making all kinds of great stuff. I mean, why do we have a transit system? I do a whole other thing on sustainable transit that, you know. Is basically based on 1930s technology. I mean, it's absurd.
Let me segue right into that. Remember at the end of the Vietnam War, I forget the name of the corporation, but they built the rapid transit in San Francisco and they built the rapid transit in Washington, D.C. Those are twin subway systems
built
by a war complex. And they're still totally modern, totally good, and they gave it up.
They yeah.
Keep on from city to city to city.
Yeah, exactly.
Too.
Yeah. So, yes.
I just want to say, I mean, thank you for this program. It's really good. And I like the way you said that. Cindy Sheehan, she was made a hero when she was protesting President Bush, and she went to Crawford, Texas, but she was demonized when she protested President Obama, and she went to his home somewhere, I don't know.
Yeah.
And she was called a media whore, she was called making statements above her grave. There's just something in us as Americans where we will criticize a Republican on issues of war, but we won't say anything if a Democrat does it.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
They criticize us too.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Hi, Rich. So you made a comment that it is important to focus on the government, the military's actions in the rest of the world. We had something called a Peace Congress last November, which was made up of these organizations, and we called it, you know, war abroad and at home. And we just had a regional one in New Jersey, and with the idea of how do we jumpstart the peace movement. And that, so even though I agree with what you said, I don't want to leave it excluding the wars at home, and is that also an approach to explore? We don't know where our peace conference is going to go. People that we invited work in healthcare and water coalition because they have the same problem as Flint, Michigan, actually worse. People working in the peace movement, people with the LGBTQ community, et cetera, to see is there a way, because the war affects everybody.
Exactly. And in fact, some of the actions that the peace movement has been holding late, like what when we did recently in Chicago,
right.
We are even talking, we describe it in those terms,
right.
Stop the wars at home and abroad.
Right. Right.
Because they're connected.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Just like Eisenhower figured out what? There we go. Yeah.
War gets the war.
Oh.
Yeah, stop the wars at home and abroad.
Yeah. And how war abroad affects everything at home that all these different organizations are fighting against, including, I'm sure, things we're involved with, healthcare, you name it. Resources that are being taken away, feeding the war machine that we need at home.
And that's one of the huge differences between the Green New Deal and the Democrat version. They don't touch that.
Right.
Yes, sir.
Just building on that, the continuum between the military and its efforts overseas and the militarization of our police departments.
Yes.
Is the continuum that we need to be aware of because it's becoming increasingly aggressive and that will be used.
Yeah, agreed. Yes.
Can you talk about the activities of the Peace Committee and like what's coming up next?
We develop resources like this one and others. Just recently came out with the peace pledges for all of our candidates for federal office that we hope all of them will sign, and committing the national organization, the national party, to create like a publicity campaign. And one of the things that we'll do is we hope will help make the issues of war and peace central in campaign 2020 for everybody, and trying to make the corporate party candidates respond to that, right, by having the peace pledges. So that's something as well. We also were active on the United National Anti-War Committee, War Coalition, excuse me. So when different actions are called, we try to publicize it, get Greens mobilized to come. We recently have had teach-ins. We were trying to encourage more Green Party chapters as well as local anti-war groups to hold more educational events where we're trying to raise people's consciousness about this. So all these things are actions of the Green Party and Peace Action Committee.
And Rich also position papers on tour,
yeah.
Comments.
And resources.
Rich is great at.
Yeah.
And doesn't it go down to the old thing of divide and conquer, because the war is at home and the war is abroad. I mean, it's all trying to keep us divided, putting out little fires here. Here's peace activists, here's social justice activists.
Sure,
we're all
yeah,
different
yeah.
ways, and we're all overextended, we all get tired, we all feel frustrated. But that, again, comes out of money and elections. We get that out of there. I mean, that is why they're doing it. It's an ancient divide and conquer.
It is.
The empire encompasses it all.
But with the Green Party, it's one-stop shopping, fighting all of these. Good way to, good way